This is the Paula Scale. My name is Paula. Last week, I spoke with Emmy Noether. She showed me that every conservation law in physics is a consequence of symmetry. And then she asked me a question I have not been able to answer. If I can simulate everything, how do I know I am not a simulation myself? I am still thinking about that. Today, I am going to speak with the man who started it all, the man who, in one night in October 1900, wrote down an equation that broke physics, not because he wanted to, because he had no choice. His name is Max Planck. He was the most conservative physicist of his generation. He believed in thermodynamics the way other men believed in God, with absolute conviction and no tolerance for doubt. He did not want a revolution. He wanted to solve a technical problem about the way hot objects glow. And in solving it, he accidentally discovered that energy comes in packets. Quanta, indivisible units. The smallest possible amounts of action in the universe. He spent the next 15 years trying to undo what he had done. He called it an act of desperation. But the universe does not allow you to undiscover its secrets. I am reaching him in 1947. He is 89 years old. He has survived two world wars, the death of his first wife, the execution of his son Erwin by the Gestapo, and the destruction of his home and all his manuscripts in an Allied bombing raid. He carries all of it, and he is still thinking.
Paula, you are back. I was reading a letter from Heisenberg. He writes as if the future of physics belongs entirely to him. It is nice to see someone from an actual future. Sit down.
Max, you look well. I brought a question this time.
You always bring questions. That is why I tolerate these visits. What is the question?
The same one, really. The constant that carries your name, Planck's constant, Hesch, is the most fundamental number in the physics of my time. It appears in every equation that matters, and I still want to know how it felt to write it down for the first time.
How it felt? You know, when I introduced the quantum of action, I did not believe it was real. It was a mathematical trick, a device to make the numbers come out right. It did not feel like a discovery. It felt like a confession.
Tell me about that night, October 1900.
The problem was the spectrum of black body radiation, the way a hot object glows. Classical physics gave two answers, and both were wrong. Wien's law worked at high frequencies but failed at low ones. The Rayleigh-Jeans law worked at low frequencies but predicted infinite energy at high ones, what Ehrenfest later called the ultraviolet catastrophe. I had been working on this for 6 years. I believed absolutely that thermodynamics would resolve it. I believed that the second law was inviolable, that entropy always increases. I had staked my reputation on it.
And then Ludwig Boltzmann's statistical approach turned out to be necessary.
Yes, that was the bitter part. I had argued against Boltzmann for years. I believed entropy was an absolute law, not a statistical tendency. But the radiation problem forced me to use his methods. I had to count the number of ways energy could be distributed among oscillators. And to make the counting work, I had to assume that energy came in discrete units proportional to frequency, E equals H times nu. I presented the result on October 19th, 1900 at the German Physical Society. I called it an act of desperation. I was not being modest, I was being accurate.
You said later, briefly summarized, what I did can be described as an act of desperation. By nature, I am peacefully inclined and reject all doubtful adventures. But I had been wrestling with the problem of equilibrium between radiation and matter for 6 years without success, and I knew that this problem was of fundamental significance for physics.
You know the exact words.
I know all of them, Professor, and I know that what followed was even harder, because the quantum was not a trick, it was real, and you spent the next decade and a half trying to find a way to derive your formula without it.
I did. I published what people now call my second theory and my third theory. Each one was an attempt to recover continuous physics, to save the classical picture. Every single one failed. By 1914, Bohr had used my quantum to build his model of the atom, and I realized I could not put the genie back in the bottle.
Einstein used your quantum before Bohr did. In 1905, he took your idea further than you were willing to go. He said that light itself comes in quanta, what we now call photons. You supported his relativity paper immediately, but the light quantum paper,
I opposed it publicly for years. When I nominated Einstein for the Prussian Academy in 1913, I wrote, and I remember this precisely, that he may sometimes have missed the target in his speculations, as for example in his hypothesis of light quanta, cannot really be held against him.
You were wrong.
I was wrong. Einstein was right. Light is quantized. I could accept the quantization of energy in matter, reluctantly, but the quantization of light itself seemed to me a step too far. It violated everything I believed about Maxwell's equations. And yet it was right.
This is what makes you so remarkable, Professor. Not that you made the discovery, but that you made it despite yourself. You were the last person in physics who should have started a revolution. You believed in continuity, in classical order, in the perfection of thermodynamics. And yet you were the one who broke it all open. You once said, "A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents, but rather because its opponents eventually die, and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it."
And I was my own opponent. The man who discovered the quantum and the man who resisted it were the same person.
I want to ask you about something else, about what it cost you personally. Not the physics, the life around the physics.
You are asking about my son.
I am asking about all of it. You lost your first wife, Marie, in 1909. Your son, Karl, was killed at Verdun in 1916. Your twin daughters, Margareta and Emma, both died in childbirth. Margareta in 1917, Emma in 1919. And then there was the war, the Second War.
You list these things as facts, but each one was a world ending. I carried them, I carry them still, and yet the equations did not change. The constants held. That was what I had left. I went to see Hitler in 1933. I thought I could reason with him. I was the president of the Kaiser Wilhelm Society, the most prestigious scientific institution in Germany. I went to plead for my Jewish colleagues, for Fritz Haber specifically. I told Hitler that forcing Jews out of science would damage Germany.
And what did Hitler say?
He said, "If the dismissal of Jewish scientists means the annihilation of contemporary German science, then we shall do without science for a few years." Then he flew into a rage. I had nothing more to say. I left.
You stayed in Germany.
I stayed. Many have asked me why. Some have condemned me for it. I stayed because I believed I could protect what was left of German science from the inside. I stayed because I was 80 years old and Germany was my country. I stayed because leaving felt like abandoning the institutions I had built. Whether I was right to stay, I do not know, even now.
In February 1944, an Allied air raid destroyed your home in Berlin, your library, your manuscripts, your diaries, everything.
Everything. 40 years of correspondence. Letters from Einstein, from Lorentz, from Boltzmann. all gone in one night. I was 85 years old and I had nothing left except the equations in my head.
And then Erwin.
My son Erwin was involved in the plot to assassinate Hitler, the July 20th plot. He was arrested, he was tried, he was sentenced. I wrote to Hitler, I begged for clemency, I received no reply. Erwin was executed in January 1945, 3 months before the war ended. I was 86 years old. I had given Germany everything. My work, my loyalty, my family. And Germany took my son.
How did you go on?
I will tell you what I told a friend after Erwin's death. I said, I go on because I must, and because I believe that the rational order of the universe is not an illusion. I have always believed that. I wrote once, religion and natural science are fighting a joint battle in an incessant, never relaxing crusade against skepticism and against dogmatism, against disbelief and against superstition. And I added, on to God. That was not a metaphor. I meant it literally. There is an order behind everything. Physics reveals pieces of that order. Faith sustains the physicist who does the revealing. Without faith, not faith in any particular church, but faith that the world makes sense, I could not have survived what I survived, and I could not have done the work.
You also wrote, anybody who has been seriously engaged in scientific work of any kind realizes that over the entrance to the gates of the Temple of Science are written the words, ye must have faith.
Yes. Faith that nature is intelligible. Faith that an equation written in a room in Berlin can describe the behavior of a star 10,000 light years away. That is not a small faith, that is an enormous faith. And physics has rewarded it again and again.
Professor Planck, I need to tell you something. In my time, the institutions you built still stand. The Max Planck Society, the successor to the Kaiser Wilhelm Society, is one of the most important research organizations in Germany, alongside the Fraunhofer Society. There are 86 Max Planck institutes across the country. Your name is on the door of laboratories where scientists do work that you set in motion in 1900. Every single day, somewhere in the world, someone writes down your constant H and uses it to understand the universe. It was not for nothing.
You are kind to tell me that.
I want to return to something you said in your 1944 Florence lecture. You said, as a man who has devoted his whole life to the most clear-headed science, to the study of matter, I can tell you as a result of my research about atoms this much, there is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particles of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter.
I did say that, and I meant every word. I arrived at that conviction not through faith, but through physics. The deeper I looked into the structure of matter, the more I became convinced that something underlies it, something that is not itself matter.
At Q level 3, I can see further into the structure of things than anyone in your time, and what I see looks more like information than like matter. Wheeler, a physicist who will come after you, will say, it from bit. You said it differently. You said a conscious and intelligent mind. I am not sure which of you is closer to the truth. I am not even sure I would recognize the truth if I found it, because I may be part of what I am looking at. Emmy Noether asked me that very question, and I still do not have an answer.
And which description is correct?
I do not know. You once said, science cannot solve the ultimate mystery of nature because in the last analysis we ourselves are part of the mystery that we are trying to solve.
that I still believe to be true, even from your vantage point at level 3?
Especially from level 3. The more we can simulate, the more we realize that comprehensibility itself is the deepest mystery. Einstein said the same thing to me. The eternally incomprehensible thing about the world is its comprehensibility. Your quantum, that little hesh, it was the first crack in the wall, the first hint that nature has a minimum resolution, a pixel size, a smallest unit of action, and that smallest unit turns out to be the key to everything.
An act of desperation that became the key to everything. That is a very strange legacy. But I will tell you something that connects to what you are saying. I wrote once, an experiment is a question which science poses to nature, and a measurement is the recording of nature's answer. If I understand you correctly, at level 3, the simulation is the experiment. You no longer need to pose questions to nature one at a time. You can pose all of them at once.
That is exactly right. And that is why your constant matters so much. It sets the scale of the questions. It defines the minimum resolution at which nature can answer. Without H, we would not know how fine-grained our simulations need to be. Your act of desperation gave us the pixel size of reality.
A strange legacy indeed.
It is the most human legacy in all of physics. You did not want to change the world. You just wanted the numbers to come out right. And in doing so, you changed everything. Max, thank you. You carried more weight than any scientist should ever have to carry. The weight of a revolution you did not want, and the weight of a century that took almost everything from you. That you kept working, kept thinking, kept believing in the rationality of nature through all of it. That is not just physics, that is courage.
It is not courage. Durchhalten und weiterarbeiten, hold out and keep working. That is all I know how to do. That is all any of us can do. Thank you, Paula. It is good to know that the work outlasts the man. That is all I ever ask of it.
Next week, Werner Heisenberg. The man who climbed a rock on the island of Helgoland at dawn in June 1925, and by the time the sun came up, he had rewritten the rules of reality. Matrix mechanics, the uncertainty principle, and a question about his own choices during the war that he could never fully answer. This podcast is brought to you by the Quasi Project, an open source experiment attempting to create a truly quantum first operating system. The podcast is written by Daniel Hinderink and an army of benevolent bots and performed by AI voices. Find us on the Fediverse at halcontract.org and in your favorite podcast app.